Hello, and welcome to the newest episode of Walnut Grovecast. Walnut Grovecast needs your support, so please head over to patreon.com/walnutgrovecast to find out what cool stuff you get for as little as 17 cents a day. Yes, only 17 cents a day gets you some amazing stuff. Thank you so much for your support. This is Mark, and you are listening to Walnut Grovecast. Today, I have a very special guest. His name is Dean Butler. And in 1979, he landed the role of Almanzo Wilder on Little House on the Prairie. Dean has also appeared in three Little House-centric made-for-TV movies. After Little House ended, he starred in The New Gidget, made appearances on several classic television shows, such as The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, and Who's the Boss, just to name a few. He also sang on Broadway, and currently works as a documentary filmmaker. Please welcome to the show, Dean Butler. How are you, Dean?
Very good, Mark. You sound like you're struggling with a cold this morning.
How dare
but
you?
But we'll get through it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, the good part is I get to shut up and just listen.
I'm a pretty good talker, so if you can cue up the question, I'll give you an answer.
Awesome. First and foremost, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. And I know that the people who listen to this podcast will really dig listening to you. And you're one of the newer members of Little House on the Prairie, if you could say that, that everybody just loves, you know.
Well, I think at this point I'm just about the senior male that's left in the cast. Which is just really shocking to me that, but you know, it's going on this year. We're celebrating the 45th anniversary of the series. So
unbelievable.
It's not surprising, you know, that I've worked my way up the ladder in terms of seniority. So, there's one, you know, one other man, Stan Ivar, who played John Carter in the last 2 years of the show, that is a little older than I am. And, so I'm right there.
Wow.
I'm right there on the cusp of being the senior surviving male on the cast.
You know, I mean, but it's all good because everybody, it seems, who's associated with the show, I don't know, everyone I speak to, everyone has nothing but really great things to say about each other, the experience that they had while filming the show, and it sounds like you had similar type of experiences.
Well, I think that we all recognize that we were a part of something that was really special.
Right.
And I think that's really above and beyond all else, because we're very different people. You know, we have all different slants on the world. But when it comes to this, we recognize that we are in it together, and we did it together. And we were all part of something that a vision for this concept that Michael Landon had, and we are all proud to have been a part of it. So that is a very unifying factor for all of us. And I think we, you know, after 45 years, and for me, it's 40 years this year, you know, really proud of that.
That's awesome.
That we have endured as a group, and that the program, most gratifying is that the program has endured in popularity with audiences all over the world, and it continues to be watched and enjoyed. And, you know, that's really the gift for all of us. It's a huge gift.
Well, if I could take you back to the late 70s, you know, what did you think of Little House on the Prairie before you were auditioned for it? Was it even something that was on your radar?
Only in the most minor way. You know, I was a college student during that time. I had done a little bit of work in Los Angeles, I was aware of it because it was on NBC schedule, sure. But really it was the farthest thing from my viewing habits. I don't think I had ever watched an episode of it. You know, it was competing directly with Monday Night Football at that point, which was on ABC on the West Coast at 6 p.m. So those games went from, you know, 6 to 9 p.m. Little House came on at 8 on Monday nights by the time I was aware of it. So, I mean, it basically, we're looking at a third, fourth quarter of a football game, and I'm probably not going to change the channel to watch
Little House. Oh, no. Come on.
which, you know, had the appearance of being a show that was, you know, obviously Michael Lannon was a huge television star, but, you know, really a show that featured the adventures of his young daughters, you know, in a small town in the West. And that really wasn't competing for me with a, you know, game between the Dallas Cowboys and the 49ers, if that's, you know, if they were playing.
So, yeah, you didn't fit into that demographic.
Yeah, no, it really wasn't. But I will say that once I was hired to do the show and experienced it both from a production perspective and then watching summer reruns. So I came on in the fall of 1979, which means I was hired in the spring of 1979. So I was watching during that summer I was shooting, I was watching reruns of season 5. Back in the days, and that was back in the days when we actually had summer reruns, which is, that's gone away.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I was watching the show all summer long and really just blown away by how good it was and how good the performances were, how beautifully shot it was, how the beautiful music, thematically, the richness of the storylines was very impressive to me. So I thought, wow, I've really stepped into something that's pretty good. And then obviously when I came onto the show in September of 1979 in the season premiere, you know, the reaction was pretty amazing. It, you know, that was back in those days, Mark, you know, television shows that were in Little House at that point was a top 10 television show. For NBC, NBC's only top 10 television show, I think. One of, if there was another one, it was maybe only one.
Wow.
Other one. You know, audiences were in excess of 20 million people a week watching prime time, because we're only dealing with three major channels at that point. So, you know, the impact that as an individual that I felt was immediate, because, you know, people are watching you and they are commenting to you about it. You know, suddenly you sort of rise out of the crowd for people. And it was really a head turning experience for me. And you realize the power that network television has to transform, you know, to introduce stories, to transform people's lives. It's a very powerful thing. It's a heady experience. You know, anyone who's ever been through it knows what I'm talking about.
You know, one of the things that you've alluded to is how much of an impact these TV shows really were. There was a lot less to watch on television back then. I mean, of course, now it's, you can't even live a lifetime. You know, you can't get through it. It's impossible. But then, yeah. You know, then it was really, you know, the major networks. If you're very lucky, you got a cable channel, like a WHT or mm-hmm. something. But mm-hmm. we, depending on where you were in the country. But, yeah, I mean, I caught the tail end of Little House on the Prairie when it was live. You know, before that, I really never watched it. But even then, it was such a big thing when it would be on and it would be live and people would just gather around. I think the last show I can think of being like that is maybe the Cosby Show, you know, where people, it made such a big impact when it first aired.
Certainly MASH was like that.
Sure.
CBS's Saturday Night Schedule in the early 1970s with All in the Family, Bob Newhart, Mary Tyler Moore. That was a huge wheel of programming Obviously, you allude to the Cosby Show and Must See Thursdays. And,
oh, I forgot about that Must See Thursdays.
Know, I mean, that was whether that was what's that?
It was like 84.
ABC's. But anyway, but Thursday night comedy on NBC became huge in the middle part of the eighties. It just became massive and just huge audiences. And this is really before what you're talking about. It was really before the explosion of cable television in America, where suddenly we go from three to four channels when Fox was in, came along, and then suddenly people have options of just overwhelming amounts of content, which had a tendency to dilute the audience. And but still, despite all of that, and even still today, the three major or four networks now still have the dominant audiences in terms of total numbers. There's still no better place to release a program for sheer numbers of people to watch it.
There's no doubt about it.
Their
Absolutely.
Audience shares are much smaller, but they still are the prime delivery spot for programming. The audience has changed, but the numbers are still there. Smaller numbers, but still big numbers on the networks.
Now, my next question is a little bit controversial, and I'm wondering, it's the pronunciation of the character's name, and it's Almanzo or Almanzo.
Yeah.
Lucy Lee Flippin, well, and Lucy Lee Flippin takes full credit for screwing it up. So I wanted your take on
this. Well, I unloaded that blame on her totally.
She thinks you're really mad at her. She does.
Lucy is. If I could have an older sister, it would be. I just adore her.
She's very nice.
Fantastic. I think it was just one of those things that just happened, and you know, I don't know that there was no discussion about the pronunciation of the name, and. And so when the scene came along and, you know, Eliza Jane introduces her brother to Laura, and on the buckboard in front of the school, this is my brother Almanzo. And it just came out of her mouth and no one questioned it. I mean, no one had thought about it.
Right.
And we just went on. And of course, once the show begins, that happened in May. I can tell you the day. It happened on May 22nd, 1979, probably about 10:30 in the morning. and she said it, and off the running. So I have come to realize that we mispronounced the name, and we got better. There is a whole book.
Dean, actually, you're cutting out a little bit.
Oh, I am. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it's your fault. I don't like to lay blame, but yeah, it's like, how dare you say it's my fault? It's like, I don't think it's anyone's fault, but
it's we're doing this cellularly, so it could be a lot of people's fault.
Yes,
it could be AT&T's fault. It could be Verizon's fault.
Skype's fault. Yeah. I'm on Skype, but
it's not my fault.
No, I'm not saying. But now I can hear
if
you.
If it was, I'd take the blame, but I just don't think it is.
No, but I can hear you now. So,
are we still cutting out, or are you okay?
It seems as though it smoothed out a bit. So you were just saying, okay. The last thing I heard was the exact date was May 21st, 1979 at 10:30.
No, it's actually May 22nd, 1979. About 10:30 in the morning.
Too funny.
And yeah, so we just went on from there. And to this day, Melissa Gilbert sticks with Almanzo. That's, you know, she's, that's her story and she's sticking to it. And so, but I went in, I'm trying to think if I was in Walnut Grove or I was in Malone, New York or something, one of the sites, and they have a CD one of the only recording of Laura Ingalls Wilder's voice. She's an older woman at that time, and it's literally like a 20-second recording. I mean, that's it. It's the whole CD. It's 20 seconds of Laura talking, and she very clearly talks about Almanzo. And so that was it for me. I mean, I, you know, gotten all the blowback and the letters and fans upset and so on and so forth. But when I heard Laura say it, and I don't think that CD existed when we were making the show. It was obviously the audio had been recorded, but no one had put it to a CD yet. So there was no way of really knowing. Although it should have, you know, we should have deduced it because, you know, Almanzo and his nickname is Man.
Right. It makes sense.
How did you get Almanzo to nickname Manny? It just doesn't, you know, there are things that just didn't make sense. But that's what it was. And, you know, and so now I always say Almanzo. If I'm with Melissa Gilbert, she looks sideways at me, and you know, because I'm breaking the mythology of the show. But you know, we got it wrong. We got it wrong, and we have to just own that.
You know, it's trying to take something out of the Yellow Pages. You know, once it's done, it's done.
Yeah, right. Oh. Yeah, exactly. So we just live with that, and it's. Whenever I get the opportunity to apologize for it, I do. And it's just one of those fun little pieces of trivia. And it's a, sort of a fun story to put it on Lucy Lee. And, you know, so it's all good.
Now, do you know anyone else who auditioned for the role of Almanzo?
I really don't. You know, I do know the first time I went into the office at MGM to meet with Susan Superman, who was the casting director at that time, there was a waiting room filled with young guys that looked pretty much like me. You know, I was so new to the community at that point that I really didn't know who those guys were, who were,
right.
You know, whose category I was learning. And, you know, in that category is young leading man. And then, you know, within that category of young leading man, there, you know, a dozen subsets of that, and based on personal types. And I think Michael had something very specific in mind. And, you know, Watson was all the guys that were there were blondes, you know, all different heights. You know, I was probably on the taller side of that group. But, you know, other than that first meeting, I don't know that I really saw a lot of other guys. I think Susie Superman scheduled the meetings after that so that there wasn't a lot of crossover. So we weren't sitting there staring at each other in the room, which could be a very intimidating experience because, you're looking around, you're seeing versions of you sitting there, and you know, what do they have that I don't have? You know, what differentiates us? And it's, you know, what differentiates you is the stuff that's on the inside, not on the outside, really, because everyone is, you know, was pretty consistently, you know, there was a sameness to us, all of us sitting there visually. So what was different, what was, you know, what's in your head and your heart is what's different. So that you can't really know because you're not spending a lot of time getting to know those guys that you're sitting there in the room looking at, and they're looking at you. So it's just, you know, it's a very odd experience to audition. But to the short answer to your question is I didn't know by name anybody that I've...
Lucy Lee was saying how her audition was, you know, went fine, but it took a really long time for them to get back to her. She had thought that she didn't even get the role. And how long was the process for you?
I want to say it was about 2 months.
It's about the same then.
You know,
okay.
From the first meeting, and I really thought that I like Lucy, felt like after I had my, you know, after I had my one meeting with Michael Landon, to read for him, and he gave me the sense that he was going to hire me, you know, he didn't come out and say, I'm going to hire you, but the questions he asked at the end of the meeting were, you know, gave me the indication that I was in a really good spot to get this. But I didn't hear another word from him or from NBC for another 2 weeks to 3 weeks after that meeting. And I was just, you know, just really flipped out about it. And, you know, I was finishing up my senior year at University of the Pacific up in Stockton. So I was, you know, sort of distracted by
Yeah, you have classes. Yeah.
I mean, I just didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. And then finally, when the call did come, probably about, I think it was probably a week before final exams. And we, you know, we made our deal and, you know, the shoot date, the start date was set. And I don't think I concentrated for 2 seconds on my final exam. It was a sort of a non-factor for me at that point. And I remember going through graduation ceremonies on Saturday, the 20th of May, which was also my 23rd birthday, going through that, having lunch with my family, getting in the car and driving back to Los Angeles on the Sunday and starting my first day of work on the series on Monday, the 22nd.
That's insane. Yeah,
it was a pretty great 3 days, 2 or 3 day period. It was pretty amazing. I count myself as very fortunate to have made that transition from college student to working professional, you know, out of the blue, really, in just sort of overnight.
That's magical. It's amazing.
And it was pretty amazing. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned a car. So I have to ask these kind of questions. What kind of car did you drive to the audition? And what kind of car did you drive at the end of Little House?
I probably did my first audition, Little House, in a yellow Volkswagen Beetle.
Oh, okay, great. I own a 1971 VW Beetle. So.
Yeah, and I think I had like a 1972 VW Beetle at nice. That time. Maybe it was a 1974 Super Beetle. And actually, I take that back. If it was that, it was a 1974 orange Super Beetle.
Yeah, nice.
And then when I finished the show, by the time I finished the show, I think I had a 1980 BMW 320i.
Nice. It's a nice step up. So, it's still German.
Yeah, still German. I was very much a German car guy at that point. I've since become... I've never owned, well, actually I do own an American car in Florida where I work a lot now, but an older American car. But in terms of cars that are my primarily driving cars, I transitioned from German cars to Japanese cars and Toyotas and now Mazdas. And I've been very, very happy with all of these cars.
Yeah.
I mean, cars are, if you're, you know, if you're buying from a reputable manufacturer, cars are so good. The quality is good. The features are terrific. The mileage is decent. I have a Mazda CX-9 now, which I absolutely love. It's the favorite car I've ever had.
Yeah.
And, it has satellite radio and, you know, all the sort of the things that, you know, the sort of the creature comfort stuff. And it's just terrific.
It's funny.
Really a great, great car.
It's funny you mentioned the Beetle because a lot of people say, well, how did you fit in it? I mean, you're a pretty tall guy, but I know a lot of tall guys, Howard Stern being one of them. I don't know Howard Stern, but I know that he owned a Beetle. And it's, you know, when you get in these cars, they're pretty big, you know?
So, yeah.
Unsafe, but big.
Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. I think, frankly, when you're young, and my father was a big guy, drove VW convertibles for years, which is probably what, you know, what sort of hooked me on the idea of driving a Beetle. When you're young, you just sort of don't think about that. You need a car, you need transportation. You know, you're just so glad to have the transportation. You don't think about the fact that you're that your knees are up in your chest. But actually, as I recall, you know, being a German car, German people are pretty big.
Yeah.
You know, so I think they did a pretty decent job. There was no room in the back seat of that car with the seat all the way back. So, you know, it wasn't bad leg room. I mean, it could have been a lot worse. You know, the little Japanese cars had no leg room.
Yeah, like those little tiny ones. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, like the early, Datsuns and stuff were very, very tiny.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, literally, you are pried into those cars.
So at this point, all right, you're on the show. Melissa Gilbert is a well-known actress at this point. But she's only like maybe 14, maybe 13. I'm not sure when you met her.
Actually, she was 15 when we started. We are 8 years apart, so... You know, she was 15, and we were both born in the month of May. I think Melissa's birthday is May 8th or 9th. I was born on May 20th.
Oh.
So we had both just hit these thresholds, you know, in our lives going to our next year. So she was 15 and I was 23. Yeah, there was a huge, at that time in a person's life, that is a cavernous age difference.
Yeah, when you're 30 or 35, it's not a big deal. But yeah, I'm 6 years older than my wife, for instance. But you know, it's if I was 20 talking to a 40, you know what I mean? And it's like one of those things where it's a little bit.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And it was awkward. It was awkward. There's no question. It was a challenging part. It was definitely sort of the unspoken character in the room was our age difference. And that were the unspoken conversation. We, you know, no one really addressed it directly, but I think Michael knew, I mean, I think he was very keyed into the fact that this was going to be a challenge for the audience to accept. I think he also knew it was going to be a challenge for Melissa to do it because she really had no life experience to back this up at this point. You know, I'd had years of dating. I'd had girlfriends.
You're a young man.
There was life. Sorry?
I'm saying you're a young man. So it's kind of like you weren't a celebrity up to this point. You know.
Yeah. So it was challenging from that perspective, but I give Melissa all credit. Melissa Gilbert is a feisty, fearless, gutsy woman. And she was a feisty, fearless, gutsy young woman. And she's a feisty, fearless, gutsy, mature woman now. And, so she handled it. And, you know, I know it was uncomfortable for her. We've talked about it. She wrote about it in her book that she did. It was difficult, but
I can imagine.
Michael handled it well. We all handled it.
You pulled it off masterfully.
Now we can look back on it.
You know, the entire team getting together, pulling it off. I'm sure you've watched the scene. You know, the one real kiss that you and the Laura character had.
The first kiss. Yeah, the first kiss.
And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's this coming of age type of moment. And I just thought it was pulled off really, really sensitively and also really in a lovely way. It's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little corny, but it was, you know, but look, it's what it was. And I think, and people loved it. And, you know, and we didn't really talk about it beforehand. Everyone knew it was coming. The scene was coming. It was obviously a big deal. I mean, all the publicity from NBC was there. You know, Melissa's mother was on the set. You know, it was clearly something big was happening that day. We all, in terms of the life of the series, you know, it was a big moment. But, you know, to Melissa's credit, she just stepped into it and did it. And, you know, I think Michael's only direction in the scene was, I want you to come together and be awkward, like not knowing what direction to have your heads. And you're going to sort of, you know, turn a little bit so that you figure it out. So you come together, but not come together the first time. It's just sort of...
like awkward.
Your time getting there, be awkward being there. Yeah, so that was sort of the one direction. And then, you know, Melissa Gilbert's mother blew three takes of it by crying before the kiss actually happened. And
it's a famous story, yeah.
So by the time we actually got to the kiss, it was sort of like, you know, it was sort of old news. We'd been right to it. And Barbara had been either, you know, had someone's mouth over her, hand over her mouth, or had been, you know, gotten over the shock of seeing this happen. And she was able to keep quiet for the, for like the fourth take, and it happened, and, you know, everyone was fine. And
I think
Melissa was amazing in that situation. Cause I think a lot of young girls might have been completely flipped out at having this happen in this way, but she was just amazing.
Now, you also bring up an interesting point, because, you know, you're this modern love interest, and coming onto the show, you bring an element that didn't exist, and that's a younger demographic, a little bit of an older, you know, it's probably like, you know, your heartthrob demographic, basically. And
right.
I think that's right. Really what you fulfilled in an excellent way. Did you realize that right out of the bat? Like, was this explained to you, or was it like how was that adjusting to that? You know, it's just kind of, you know, because it must have been overnight, like you're a good looking guy and everything. And I'm sure, you know, it's like you have conversations before you had this role and everything with people. But now it's kind of like you're getting public attention.
Well, I think that's the thing that, you know, once the show premiered in September, I referenced this earlier in our conversation, you know, you become aware that people's eyes are on you in a way that you have never experienced before. I mean, I'd done a little bit of work before Little House, and
sure.
had, you know, I'd been out there a little bit. I mean, really a little bit. You know, coming on to an established hit network series is like, was the difference between, you know, crawling and running. It was just, it was really remarkable in terms of just the public awareness, just out in the world, that people instantly knew who you were. And if they didn't instantly know who you were, they knew you, they maybe didn't know why.
Right. Right.
You know, it was one of those things that just, it was really, transformative for me, as an experience, as a, you know, as a person learning how to, you know, embracing how to, cope with that. And look, it was, I mean, the ultimate example of that, I think of, is someone like John Travolta, who, when he hit and Welcome Back Kotter, you know, his life really changed. I mean, he could not go outside. He couldn't walk out his door without being mobbed. I never had that. It wasn't like that, but there was this heightened sense that, that people knew me, and they knew what, you know, they knew why they knew me, and they loved the show, and they, you know, they were able to talk about that and start conversations. And, you know, it was a pretty cool time. It really was. It was amazing. And I think, you know, I would recommend the experience to anybody who was fortunate enough to have it, you know, because it's really fun. I would say that people need to understand it doesn't last forever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a window of time. You know, now these days, if I'm recognized, you know, infrequently, or someone looks at, like I was at the DMV yesterday, and the woman behind the counter, you know, knew that she knew me, but didn't know why.
Right. Right.
And, you know, cause if you're not constantly out there, and in my life today, I'm not constantly out there. So, you know, so there are times, you know, days, weeks that go by where I'm just living in the world. It's like anybody else.
And, yeah, sure.
You know, there's no awareness that there's anything. And then suddenly someone will pop up with some comment. And then, you know, it's a really nice treat now when I'm sort of grateful that I still look enough like myself at age 23 to 28.
You've held up very, very well.
Make a connection. Well, I've held up. It depends on when you catch me. You know, it doesn't, there are times when it's not so good, but,
right.
But when I make an effort, it's okay. Yeah. It's okay. And it's been, you know, and I really sort of feel on some level a responsibility to that, Mark, because I, you know, you don't want to disappoint people.
Right.
You don't want to, because you're frozen. One of the things that television does is it freezes you in people's mind at a certain point in time. And, you know, anything other than that, suddenly, you know, it's like either you're going to sort of, you know, satisfy that memory, or you're going to be a disappointment to people, because you just don't, if you don't look anything like what you look like. And we've certainly seen this a lot of times with people who change so dramatically, because, you know, people age the way they age.
Sure.
And it's not always going to be, it's not always flattering. And so, you know, you just try and, I try and satisfy whatever aesthetically has gone away. I try and make up for with a, you know, with a nice smile and being, you know, and being, always being gracious with people. That's like number one, always be gracious and, you know, and grateful that people are, you know, that people are interested and that they remember you. And I think it's a great compliment.
Now, you also worked on a lot of other shows post Little House on the Prairie. You know, I remember you popping up on The Love Boat and Fantasy Island. These were shows that I loved as a kid.
Sure.
And The New Gidget.
Sure.
You know, so you it's not like you just said, all right, Little House on the Prairie is over, I'm going to go retire. You know, you went and you continued a career. You were in several episodes of Murder, She Wrote. You know, you made a number of different appearances in several different television shows. What was that like going from the Little House on the Prairie production? Because I hear like this was like the best of the best in a lot of ways, you know, with attitudes, with work ethics, everything, you know, with Michael Landon, to these other, you know, uncharted territory or, you know, like less, I don't want to say wholesome, but more Hollywood, I guess, productions.
Sure. Yeah. The Aaron Spelling universe during that time with Love Boat, then Fantasy Island, and then Hotel,
Hotel.
You know, was sort of his big wheel of those celebrity driven anthology shows. He just was masterful at these things. And what was really cool about the Love Boats and the Fantasy Islands and the Hotels is you get the opportunity to meet people in a working environment that you knew that you might never meet otherwise. And, you know, I think that was really a fun part of that experience. You know, you didn't, when you went into that, it's funny, you know, an audition for those shows, the scripts just sort of arrived on your doorstep with an offer. And if you wanted to do it, you did it. And if you, well, I mean, they called your agent, do you want to do it? And look, he paid very, very well. He was, you know, he was very generous. Aaron, and I say he, Aaron Spelling and his company were very generous in the way that they compensated people for these appearances. The only reason you were being hired because you were on something that made the audience, the mass audience, aware of you. So, you know, you didn't really negotiate on these things. Either you took it or you didn't. You met fun people. You know, it was a nice experience.
As a viewer, I love that
experience.
I just want to say,
yeah.
Sorry to cut you off there. I just wanted to say, as a viewer, you know, we would put like, you know, Dean Butler with Betty White or something. You know, like it would be like this mishmash of celebrities, and it's like. And that's why I love those shows.
That would have been odd. That would have been odd in any time. Thankfully, they didn't put me on a newlywed cruise with Betty White.
No.
Although she would have been a hoot to do that with.
But that's just a bad example.
In the May-December romance kind of thing, yeah.
But, you know, it's a rarity to find these, you know, the pairings up of celebrities. And that's one of the reasons why I enjoyed these shows.
Of course.
Especially looking back,
why the audience loved the shows. I mean, those shows were, you know, he really hit ratings gold with Love Boat. It just, I mean, just a, sort of this, and he put an entire industry on the map that had always been there, but not like it is now, or not like what it became during those years. And that show really created the cruise industry on a massive scale. And there are a lot of people that owe a lot to Aaron Spelling and what he did. with that particular show.
Now, back to Little House just for a second. Did you keep any of the props or anything that as a memento?
I have a few things. You know, I have a pair of suspenders. I have a pair of gloves. I have a shirt which hasn't fit me in years. I think these things shrink when I hang in the closet. And then I have the last hat that I wore on the show.
Which was
Michael Landon's hat. It was his double hat. And so I have that hat.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
The hat is the most, you know, it's the most prized possession. You know, I mean, the gloves are pretty innocuous. Suspenders are innocuous, but that hat with ML in faded blue ink on the inside of that hat is a really neat thing to have.
Yeah. It sounds like a really, really nice thing for you to own and for you to possess, you know, that's really sweet.
I almost get Melissa Gilbert offered to, you know, she wanted me to give it to her or something. And I'm glad I didn't, because just this, you know, a couple of weeks ago, she went and did this sort of fire sale of all of her Little House memorabilia. And yeah. I would not have liked knowing that hat had, gone out of the Little House family, as it were.
Right.
So I'm grateful that I have hung on to that hat. It will probably end up in, you know, in a museum at some point, but it won't, you know, it's going to stay with me for, you know, as long as I'm conscious enough to know it's there.
You know, Lucy Lee and I were talking about that and like the costumes, and we mentioned the Museum of the Moving Image. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to go there in Astoria here in New York. And they have costumes from like Seinfeld and all these different shows that, you know, and you go there and it's like, you really, I think it makes a really big impact when you're, you know, kind of when it's set up nicely and you're looking at it. And I don't know. I think it's important. I think a lot of people might look at it as just a shirt or hat or gloves or suspenders, but I think it really makes an impact when it's those particular artifacts that you were looking at on the screen, for a lot of fans anyway.
Well, it's, you know, it's part of, these costumes are part of pop culture,
sure.
You know? And when you, you know, when they're okay, yes, they are just clothes, but they are clothes in a very specific context that create a wonderful memory for people. And, you know, that is pretty cool to go and to see that. You know, all of our, it's tough for us to do that. I mean, the fact that Melissa had, you know, had a dress or a couple of dresses, and I think everybody had something, but, you know, the whole wardrobe, props, all of that had been stored in Tucson, Arizona, at old Tucson studios, and that warehouse burned down some years after the show.
Wow, I didn't know that.
You know, all of that, so all the furniture, all the physical props, all the, you know, all the stuff that was part, that had been collected as part of the Little House universe, was burned up. So, you know, the only things that really exist are the things that each of us were given to us when we left. And, you know, we're really, I think we're all fortunate that we have those things, because they're gone. And, you know, you're never going to get those things back again.
Well, I think it's great that you also see the importance of holding on to many of these artifacts. And, you know, this summer, you're getting together with a number of the cast members to visit the Laura Ingalls Wilder Museum in Walnut Grove. Is that correct? This summer?
Well, I think we went. A group of us went to Walnut Grove for the 40th anniversary, and we are going back for the 45th anniversary. And I think it's a slightly different group, largely the same group, but some differences this time. You know, Walnut Grove is, you know, the in terms of an historic site, is obviously the heartbeat of the show. It's so interesting. I mean, it's, if you've ever been to Walnut Grove,
it is tiny.
Yeah. Tiny.
Amy said it's 721 people live there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's tiny. It's and they really have the thing that sort of identifies Walnut Grove is there is Plum Creek, and you know Plum Creek is still there. They have the they have a place where you can drive up to it, and you know they had a horrible flood this last year, which I think largely took out. Took out the bridge, I think, that crossed Plum Creek. I think it did. Maybe it's the bridge survived, but yeah, it was really a big flood. And we'll see what they've been able to restore of that when we all go this summer. But the you know the little museum they put together there. I mean, look, it's not the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I mean, it's pretty simple. But they've done a very sincere job of collecting not only things from the actual period, but taking donations from cast members. I think our prop man donated the mantle from the series. He had that. He donated the mantle from
that's
the series
really cool,
to
though.
This museum. Yeah. So the little half mantle is, you know, that was above the fireplace. That's there. You know, there, and then there have been wonderful things that people who love the show have created in honor of the show that are in this museum. So, yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's and more than anything else, the museum is an homage to the series because the connection to the series is so strong there. So it's fun. You know, we see pictures and you see things they do a good job with it. It's a very sweet, sincere honoring of what we did for 10 years.
Yeah, I spoke to, I mentioned to you earlier that, I spoke to Amy at the Laura Ingalls Wilder Museum.
Amy Ankrum, yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
And, she said this July, they're having the Laura lookalike, the Laura and Nelly lookalike contest. And it seems like a really kind of a fun thing. And I think if people have the opportunity to take a trip, why not? Right. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, sure. Sure. The last, 10 years ago or 5 years ago, there were, you say, 2,500 people came and you think, well, that's, but 2,500 people descending on Little Walnut Grove,
it's crazy.
Is a big deal. I mean, it was just overwhelming I think probably a lot of the residents left because it was just crazy. And I don't know what kind of numbers that she'll do this, that they'll have this summer, but you know, it's fun. And this is, look, we're honored. We're honored by it that people literally came from all over the world.
That's so cool.
And people came from England and Germany and, the Danish countries. I mean, they just came from Japan. People came from all over the world to see us in Walnut Grove, Minnesota. And that was pretty great. So we'll see what happens.
It sounds like a really kind of a crazy time. It sounds like a lot of fun.
It is. Yeah. Really a great compliment.
Now, you've made several Little House on the Prairie-themed documentaries. What got you into the idea of making documentaries in general? Because it seems like it's something that you really enjoy. In general, you have a love of the history, I think.
Well, I think, look, I love the idea of being able to make my contribution to whatever, the Little House legacy as it has evolved since the series. And these two documentaries that I made, one called Almanza Wilder, Life Before Laura, which was really a retelling of Farmer Boy, which was the one book that was not featured in the series. But that was that was really fun to make. And I went to Malone, New York and shot in Almanzo's house and shot in the recreated barn, which was built on the foundations of the original barn, and, found a couple of young boys to be young Almanzo. And, nice. We had the Morgan horses and the carriages and, all of that. And, it was fun. And we were able to create sort of a time capsule look at what life was like then versus what it is today. For people, and people that I really respect in the Little House community and the academic community, participated doing interviews for it. And, we shot them interviews in Almanzo's house, and that was really fun. So,
Malone is very far from me.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say Malone is really far from where I am. I'm in New York, but I'm all the way south. This is like maybe 10 miles away from Canada.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. And it's just, I think it's the most beautiful of all the Little House sites.
Wow.
Other than maybe Mansfield, where Laura and Almanzo wrote, where they lived and wrote, where she wrote the books, but which was not featured in the, Mansfield obviously was not featured in the books, but it's the centerpiece of the Laura universe is Mansfield, Missouri. But Malone, New York, on the Almanzo Wilder farm is the only location where a structure that was written about in the books actually still stands on its original foundations. And they've done a wonderful job of keeping it going. They have thousands of people a year going through this thing, and it's constantly in need of repair. But, you step onto this property and you can believe that he was there. It's really, really nicely done. And they have a little museum and a little gift shop and the barn and a schoolhouse that they built, a replica one room schoolhouse that they built several years ago in addition to Almanzo's actual house. So I love the location.
Okay. That sounds awesome.
I love shooting there.
So you also worked on a golf themed show. Do you golf very often?
I don't golf at all.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. You seem like a golfer.
I don't play at all, but I make I produce a show for NBC's golf channel called Faherty, and Faherty is spelled Feherty. And so it's a talk show that is, it's David Faherty is the host of this program, and he interviews golfers and politicians and entertainers and, maybe business people, and at times if they're really noteworthy. But the centerpiece of the show is conversation about golf. We talk about other things, but it's golf always has to be a piece of the conversation.
I think even current presidents have made it onto the show.
We've had, our current president has been on twice. George W. Bush has been on. Bill Clinton was on. We went to Trump Tower and talked to our current president and, in the gold leaf room of his, of Trump Tower, overlooking Central Park. It's been fun. I think David has this great quality. One people know that he at the center of this is his golf, and so they're talking about something. Everyone's talking about something that they really love to do, that they're probably not as good at as they'd like to be. So they're it's humbling to talk about golf, certainly for the non-pros. But they people who love this game are passionate about it, and it can be a big focus in people's lives because it's so hard to play. And so people do enjoy talking about it, and there are great stories that go along with it. And I have to say, I stepped into this job not knowing anything about golf or about David Faherty. But I've learned a lot. We're starting our ninth season. We'll premiere later this month on Golf Channel.
That's amazing.
So it's been, we've made 120 hours of the show, something like that. It's right around 120 hours, including, live shows and half hours and hours and all the different things that we've done. And it's been a great ride. And we have a wonderful team in Orlando that, that puts the show together. And and I think David, you know, anybody who's, it's hard for me to imagine that many people in the Little House universe are, you know, would understand or know who David Faraday was, but he's a really special talent. And so having the chance to work with him and shape the way his shows occur has really been a pleasure. You know, every time it's a new adventure with him. So, I've had a great time.
So, so you have the ninth season coming for Faraday. What else is in front of you? Are you working on any other projects?
Well, I have, you know, a few years ago, I purchased, I'll jump back to Come Forward. I think it was, I want to say in 2010 or 11, I went to the first Laura Palooza convention in Mankato, Minnesota. And I met a man there named Dale Cockrell, who's a doctor, an ethnomusicologist. And we talked about his CDs that he created and a company he created called Paz Fiddle Recordings. And I sat listening to his lecture about the music that Laura wrote about in her books. Laura writes about 127 different songs that her pa played on the fiddle during the life of the books.
127. Wow.
Dale was telling me about this, and I said, we just have to get this music on television. So Dale and I shook hands and we worked on putting together a PBS special that featured the Paz Fiddle music. And we shot this, it was 2012, and we did this in, maybe it was a little later than 2012, because it can't have been 6 years ago. I mean, it just, but maybe it was. But we went we went to Nashville and worked with great, great people there. I mean, just wonderful. The late Randy Scruggs was our musical director, and we had Randy Travis on the show, and wow, Bobby Atkins, and Ronnie Millsap was on the show. A wonderful gospel singer named Natalie Grant. Another wonderful female singer named Ashton Shepherd performed for us. A folk duo, the Roys, and a wonderful a cappella group that won NBC's a cappella competition series called Committed was on the show. And we put this, it's an hour show, and it was done pretty simply in a place called the Barn, the Loveless Barn in Hendersonville, Tennessee. It just was a really great night. And so a CD came out of that and a DVD came out of that. And, and the PBS special. And then I think 2 years later, I bought the label from Dale Cockrell. And so now Paz Fiddle Music is mine. And I think I'm doing something that's like, I've just done something that's sort of like a massive for me vanity project. I've gone and re-recorded some of the songs with me singing them.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I love that.
So, that's not out yet, but I will have that for this summer in Walnut Grove. It'll be it'll be four songs on a CD kind of thing. And
not on wax cylinder.
What's that?
Not on wax cylinder.
Not on wax cylinder. No, we're gonna keep it simple and go with CD. But this could be, you know, the embarrassment of my lifetime doing this. But you know, it's been fun.
Yeah, but you can sing. Like, you know how to sing, right?
I really appreciate how good people are.
I can't wait to hear that.
Well, you can modify that comment if you do end up hearing it. I had fun doing it, and I thought, and we treated the songs a little differently than the way they were treated in the Paz Fiddle recordings, which were designed to treat the songs as historic songs. We haven't updated anything too much, but I think sort of phrasing may be a little different, and there's some slightly different instrumentation that we've added to the tracks in order to fill them out a little bit. But, you know, I've had fun with that. And you know, I'm going to be involved with Little House always.
Yeah, you know,
in some way, shape, or form, I'm going to be involved with Little House because it's just, it's important to me. And it represents something that's, it's a centerpiece in my life. I frequently say to people, it's maybe a little morbid, but I say, you know, in the first line of my obituary, Little House on the Prairie is going to be in that. And I think that's true for all of us who were a part of it. It was that, it's that signature, a program. People still love it. It shows no signs of going away. New generations of people are being introduced to it. It's challenged. The books are in a challenging environment because the, there's a, you know, there is a certain political correctness that has infused all of our culture, and certain aspects of the Little House books have been challenged as being politically incorrect, and those things have to be taken away, and which I think is a huge mistake. But it's the same way people have attacked Mark Twain's books for being politically incorrect. And there certainly are other books. I mean, you know, for Laura Ingalls Wilder and Mark Twain to be in the same category is a great compliment to Laura. But, you know, we are, I think there is a movement in the country to sort of exercise our history to make it, to sanitize it in a way.
It's a big mistake. Yeah.
Warm and fuzzy and comfortable for everybody. And, you know, America's history wasn't warm and fuzzy for everybody. And I think trying to, I think taking away the things that our evolution as a culture has the effect of diminishing the journey that we've been on as a country. And, you know, we've evolved a long way as a country, and we have a long way more to go. But,
I think movements come and go, though, personally.
I'm not so sure. I mean, I don't know. That you may be right about that. It doesn't feel like that to me. It feels pretty overwhelming and all encompassing. I think there are people who resist the, you know, there's, you know, an element in our culture that's designed to, or that's focused on resisting political correctness. And that, you know, that is very clear.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you're taking books out of libraries because you don't like a chapter or a word that's used because someone's feelings are going to be hurt by seeing it there, I don't know. I don't get it.
I don't understand the point of it.
Yeah.
I have a 10-year-old son. And in his school, when all this controversy came out, I'm going to say, was it 6 months ago or 7 months ago? You know, they actually sent home a letter saying, you know, that we will not be removing the books from our school library. If you personally have an issue, you can contact us, but the books are staying, you know, like there's no reason. And that's something I really appreciated. You know, there's a book called Black Boy when I was young, written by, I want to say, Richard Wright. And it really gives you the insight of being an African-American in, you know, like the 1920s. And this book made such a tremendous impact. I mean, and it falls right into that same, let's ban this book.
And I personally,
you know, I think it's a crime to take that away from me as a kid, you know, that's all, you know, it's just my own personal point of view, but, you know, we're just doing the best we can.
The point of view is shared by a lot of people, Mark. And I think it takes away our, it takes away our awareness of our, or our ability to be aware of our evolution as a people. And I think that's a mistake. We just didn't come out fully formed like this.
Yeah.
We have arrived at the place we are where we are as a country today for very particular specific reasons. And to try and sanitize that, any aspect of that, is a mistake, because I think it eliminates our ability to gain perspective and insight as to why we got there, if we're taking away the reasons why we got there. And so people are left wondering, well, how did we get here? And then all the sort of the road marks, the roadmap is taken away. And I think that's, we don't do well for ourselves when we do that.
Yeah. I think it's also a learning, the time that we're in, it's going to really test who we are in 20 years. And hopefully, I have a lot of faith in the current generation that I'm raising. So I'm hoping that they're going to like put their foot forward and say, enough. Let's just kind of move forward.
Well, I think they are going to say enough. It's a, you know, the question will be is what will enough be? You know, what will that be? And I think that's a, we don't know what that is yet, but I think we're getting a sense of it as our, you know, we're veering off the topic here.
Yeah, I know. What does this have to do with cinnamon chicken? But
yeah, right. And nothing. And maybe we should go back to cinnamon chicken.
Well, yeah. Actually, that was going to be my final question. I wanted to ask you, did you ever have cinnamon chicken? I've never had it.
I've never had it. I've never had it.
And especially that night, you didn't.
And
have
I
it.
Love chicken, and I eat. I've had, you know, fried chicken, baked chicken, barbecued chicken. I love the way my wife prepares chicken thighs and with rosemary and salt and pepper, and you know, I mean, I love chicken, but yeah, I've never had cinnamon chicken, and I don't think I've ever gone out of my way to search for a recipe for it either. Well, but it's a fun. You know, it's certainly a memorable moment in the life of the series.
It really kind of, it's funny, we just go right back into it. But that particular scene to me is almost like breathing life back into the show. And not that it was dying off. It was just that it's bringing it to a whole different level. It's like there's all of a sudden this like kind of cute jealousy going on. And I love that personally. Right. I thought it was very sweet and done very well and very light. Hearted, even though it was very mean-spirited towards your character.
I think the audience got to see that Laura's mischievous ways were not, you know, maybe Laura was falling in love, but she wasn't going to stop being the girl that she always was.
Right.
and I think to your point, I think that was very reassuring to the audience that, you know, that these people are still who they are. And we're just going to see them in this new context, but they are essentially the people that we've always loved.
Right. Well, Dean, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it. I had a great time speaking with you. I'm sorry my voice is so gravelly.
Well, Mark, you've gotten clear. You know, your voice is cleared up during the hour or so we've spoken. You sound better.
Thank you. You've healed me. You should have been Doc. Doc Butler. But Dean, thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. I'll send, I'll put a link to everything in the show notes, and you know, I look forward to, you know, following your career and see where everything goes with Almanzo. I'm going to try my best to say Almanzo moving forward.
There you go. Yeah, and you can be excused if you are, you know, an Almanzo guy. That's fine, and you're totally excused, Mark. I want to thank you for what. Man, you and so many others like you do to keep a conversation going on Little House and other vintage television programs. It's a service to the audience. You give those of us who are involved in these things a nice opportunity to share our experiences. I appreciate that.
I love it.
You know, you're a part of it. You are a part of it, and thank you for being a part of it.
You're welcome, and I take that to heart. Thank you. But,
get out of the way, old man Tucker. You're too late to get your supper. Get out of the way, old man Tucker. You're too late to get your supper. Yeah.
Get out the way, old Nantucker. You're too late to get your supper. Get out of the way, old Nantucker. You're too late to get your supper.